Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert. Today is Sunday, May 5th, 2019. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and or Stitcher. Give it a 5-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now, on Twitter at Chris Lambert. This is episode 350. I have a very special guest, Grammy award-winning singer and songwriter, Van Hunt, one of my all-time favorite musicians. He's on the show, and I'm going to share that with you in a bit. I'm super excited to share it with you. Just going to talk about a couple things, and then we'll bring you to Van. This May 16th through the 19th, I'm going to be at the DC Improv opening for my good friend Paul Verzi. Andy Klein is hosting. Super excited for those shows. It's going to be a lot of fun. Check out the Patreon page. There's new stuff coming. There's new stuff coming this week because I'm recording something with some of your favorites. And it's going to be up there. So subscribe to that. And that's going to be great. I did a show last night at Gotham Comedy Club, and it was fun. I got added to the show like a couple days before, and it was really fun. The Vintage Lounge and the Gotham Comedy Club, both rooms are really fun to perform in, but it just seems like the room downstairs is a little, and the Vintage Lounge is a little more experimental, and you can kind of try out things. It's a sold out show. It's one of my favorite places to perform in the city. And that they let me perform it. And it was so much fun. Like, I was just like talking shit to them and working on new stuff. And it's a crowd that's willing to be led by you, if you will. So that was fun. Other than my conversation with Van Hunt this week, the most exciting thing that happened to me was I got a new cell phone holder for my car dashboard. Because the other one was just giving me so much trouble. Like, the phone would pop out. It's one of those things. I don't know if you guys deal with this. Like, you have your cell phone and you clamp it to one of the vents, the little vents in your AC. And sometimes it falls out, it pops out. And I said, I'm going to get another one. And I went on to Amazon and the enemy's website, and I bought one. And it's one that you can just, like, you had this, like, that 3M adhesive tape that goes under the thing, a little suction cup thingy, and it's been working. It aided me on my trek to Fuddruckers in Western New Jersey yesterday, so it's good. So I'm happy about that, and that's about it. I did see a movie I'll recommend. I saw The Long Shot, and I really enjoyed it. The Charlize Theron, Seth Rogen movie. It's one of those movies where people always talk shit, you know, about, like, Seth Rogen. Like, he's in this, he's a schlubby guy and he's always with a hot chick. I'd do the same thing. You don't think if I wrote a movie and Hollywood liked me enough to let me do a movie that I wouldn't ask Jessica Parker Kennedy to be my love interest? Are you kidding me? What are we doing here? So I think that's what most people would do, men and women. Whatever your taste is, you would have someone that you were attracted to that you liked. You would want them to be opposite you in the movie, in a romantic comedy. But it was really good. It's really funny, very timely. So I recommend it. If you are not tired of seeing these superheroes in these costumes with these lasers shooting out of their hands, then go see Long Shot. And this is coming from a dude that saw Avengers Endgame twice. So that's that. Let's get you to Van Hunt. So a couple months ago, I went to see Van Hunt in Easton, Maryland. And I was just thinking it would just be one of my norm, like things that I try to do that I'm now starting to do to have like, I guess, mental health. It's not really it's a mental health thing, or just like a nice little excursion that has nothing to do with work or stand up, where I can just enjoy myself by seeing something cool, like an art show, theater, or concert. So I went to go see Van Hunt in Easton, Maryland in mid-March, and really enjoyed the show. He crushed it, and I got to speak with him briefly after the show. And I said, oh, yeah, I saw you in Chicago, blah, blah, blah. I said, would you ever be interested in doing podcasts? Do you do podcasts? And he said, yeah. And he said, I'll just reach out and, you know, we'll make it happen. And I was like, okay. And so I followed up with him, and he gave me his manager's info, and I reached out, and we worked it out. Because sometimes, you know, when you talk to people, anybody that you ask to do, I don't know if you do a podcast yourself or how it works. And I said, sure, I'll do your podcast. And, you know, you could think it's one of those. Yeah, sure, kid. I'll do your little podcast, you know. And we made it happen. And, you know, like a couple months ago, I talked about, I mean, maybe 10 or 15 minutes, talked about how much I love this guy's music. Been following him since his career started, at least since he put out his first album. And I'm just going to have a couple of disclaimers. I told him before we started recording that I was going to try to not be that Chris Farley character in SNL where he meets like a super famous person that he really loves. He's like, remember when you did this movie and all that stuff? So I told him, I prefaced our conversation by saying that. And I tried not to. There were a couple moments where I was, I definitely fanboyed out. And I'm not ashamed. I'm not ashamed of it, because I asked him some questions and I did fanboy out, but I think he gave some really great answers. He indulged me, and he was very kind and generous with his time. And one of the things I really wanted to talk to him about was, and you'll hear it in the conversation, but I'm trying to make sure that for the music nerds and the people that are, you know, that can be critical sometimes. His third album, Popular, that got shelved and eventually released a couple of years ago. I wanted him to walk me through that a little bit, and I had a couple other artists that it happened to. It happened to Q-Tip, and I had mentioned that Amplified came out like in 90. Amplified came out in 99, his solo record, his solo project, and then he followed up like in 2002 with this project called Kamal the Abstract, and that got shelved. And I talked about how Glenn Lewis like never found his good footing after his first project, and we talked about that a little bit. But I wanted to make the comparison with him and Bilal, which I didn't. But I wanted to talk about that. But it was just like we just didn't get around to it, and I just said, "Oh, okay," because Bilal was in more the same vein along the lines of being this eclectic artist that Van Hunt is, and I just kind of dropped the ball on that and didn't ask him about that, but. I was thinking about that project, Love for Sale, that Bilal that leaked, but didn't get sold by the record label. So that was a little flub on my part. But overall, I think this is a really great conversation. And yes, I'm aware that I nerded out and I was acting like a fanboy in some moments. But if you get past that, I think it's a great conversation, and I'm honored that he spent time to do this. Also, just a sound issue. It's not even that big of a deal, but he was getting some landscaping done, and so you can hear that going on in the background a little bit. And other than that, I think it's a fucking great conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. And please enjoy my conversation with the great Van Hunt. Now, okay, all right. So, did you get to did Kyrie Irving pull up to your show in Boston?
He might have, man, but I took his name off the list. So many people bought tickets,
Are you a big basketball fan?
No, not at all. I love playing basketball, and
Okay.
I grew up playing basketball, and I was at one time a fan of the sport, but I feel like we kind of got away from the sport for it, in terms of it, the purity of it, just the sport itself.
Okay.
I'm sure that's some kind of an elitist statement, I'm sure, in some circles, but I just don't see enough passion, man. To be honest, I prefer going down to the local park in North Hollywood. There's a group of young females, man. They play way more team basketball than I've seen in the last 15 years of NBA.
Really? Okay. Well, I don't know. I think out of most sports, I gravitate to basketball a little more. And then with the NFL, I've just kind of reduced myself to just being a fan of the team with the black quarterback. And this is way before Colin Kaepernick. So like I'm 39, and so when I was 7 years old, maybe 6 or 7, when the Redskins won the Super Bowl, when Doug Williams won, that was like amazing for me. And so I just kind of like I talk about it in my act that I'm like an alt-right black quarterback supporter. And
That.
so I try to like so that's kind of where I'm at with that. But with basketball, I think now like we're finding out. I mean, it's the one sport to me where it seems like these black men can kind of seem it seems like they have a little more agency than their other counterparts to say like, where I want to go, where I want to play, what I stand for, what I don't stand for. And just listening to former players talk. And like listen like there's a podcast that came out with Quentin Richardson and Darius Miles called Knuckleheads. And you got you got former basketball players and current guys that talk about the league. And I think there is some passion there, Van. I think some of those guys do have it, but it definitely gets lost in the sauce of social media and everything that's like around it. Cause when I listen to a guy like Kevin Durant, I'm like, this guy loves the game, but sometimes he's not, even though sometimes he doesn't let the press in, they kind of, they're
Well, I mean, I should just to expound upon my statement.
sure.
These are fantastic athletes, and
Right.
they certainly exhibit great basketball, but it doesn't really serve them in their immediate circumstances and their environment to really play that way. And I totally get that, especially when you go back and look at the culture from AAU all the way up through to professional basketball. It serves them to kind of be a little more self-promotional, if you will.
Sure.
And I absolutely get that. It's for me as a viewer, though, there's just much more excitement in watching an actual holistic game of
Totally.
basketball.
Yeah, I get that. Where it's just all the other stuff is stripped away, and it's just you just have the game. That's true. Well, how was your this last tour that you did? Was that is it true that it's been about 7 or 8 years since you toured?
It was very, very close to seven, about 6 3/4.
Okay, what was that like for you getting back on the road?
Frightening, like terrifying.
Really?
But luckily, I was able to ease back into it. Well, number one, I mean, I was in a relationship that kind of ended, at least the romantic side of it ended. And so that
Okay.
was just kind of that was so distracting that that kind of took away some of the fear of
Sure.
trying to pick up a where I left off. But it also made me focus a little more on my career. And so almost immediately, simultaneously at least, I got a call from Wendy Melvoin from the Revolution, and she was asking me to come and come out with them for a date. And so that just kind of triggered it all. And then Vernon Reid from Living Color called and
Yes.
asked me if I'd do a show with him. And things just kind of kicked off from there. And then I got a call from a guy who I used to work with when I was with Capitol Records. And he was like, "Man, you looking for a manager? I'm looking for an act." And boom, we started working together. And things just kind of began to collectivize,
Yeah,
for
because
lack of a better word.
I got excited when I saw, I think it was on Twitter or Facebook. I was like, oh shit. And I had told a friend, I said, because you were doing those dates in Maryland, I ended up coming to see you in Easton. And I was
Oh,
just
wow.
telling him, I said, you should take your wife to this Van Hunt show. And then I was looking at it, I was like, shit, I should go. Cuz it was before it was before you, cuz I live in New Jersey, and I do stand up out of New York. I'm based in New York and I do
Got you.
all that stuff.
Got you.
And I said, I need to go. And I said, I need to make it a point to do something that's not stand up related. Go see an artist that I like. And as I was taking the trip, I was like, this is kind of like I'm kind of doing the road too. And I'm going to see you. But the and that was the first date on the tour, correct? Was that and it was is that was that like because I was thinking, why is he in Easton, Maryland? Like, some of my friends have performed in that spot, like had done stand up there, but I was like, he's in Easton? I was like, all right, why was did was that a strategic thing?
No, I would love to say it was, but frankly, because it worked out so well, but frankly, what happened after I got the call from Vernon Reed is I got a call from Nate Smith, a drummer,
Right.
who was also doing a couple shows in DC. And he was like, "Man, I want to do some stuff with you." And so that turned into this thing where I'm kind of just a featured guest on his show. And of course, having the new manager, he's like, "Hey, let's capitalize on this and book you some shows in the DMV area." And so that's how we started getting into booking shows in that area. And it just so happened the way the shows lined up, Easton was first, which turned out to be great because it was a perfect first show location. Not only a fantastic venue, but small, out of the way. And you get there and there's a kind of a plethora of a variety of audience members from different segments of the culture. So it was just like the perfect place to do a first show.
Yeah, and it was a great show. Like, I was up front, me and Joe, I think, that recorded your set.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't expect to be that close. And so it was just like, it was great. Like, it was just like you had everybody in there, like young, old, black, white, different races. And
Yeah, man.
it seemed like the dude, obviously the music is for the, in a way, it's the you're the ladies man and doing your thing. But I think the dudes liked you a lot more. I think we were just like, because we were just like, yeah, man, do that song. And it was interesting to me because it was just like, I was like, okay, it's not, it was just like, I guess the guys were more nerds about like your work and stuff. And because there was a young guy, there was a, after the show, it was a young white guy who's like, yeah, I'm like 22. And yeah, I just found out about the show. And it's like, damn, I found out about you when I was like 23. I think when the first out, what was that? Oh, was that 04?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. It was 04 when you came out. And I was just like, wow, the music is hitting all these demographics and it's working.
Yeah, exactly. And that, to be honest with you, was a plan. Not that I changed the way I make music in order to meet that plan, but in a way that went on too, as I was in my formative years, but I always knew that it might be a slow road, but I always knew that the music could bring in a lot of different people just because of the way I was raised, bouncing from Dayton, Ohio to Arlington, Texas to Atlanta, Georgia, and living in just all these different kind of environments and being into so many different things from fashion to basketball to track and field, boxing. So I always wanted to appeal to a lot of different segments of the society, if only to show everybody, you know, that we can all agree on something.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It was interesting that night too, 'cause like you what as a consumer of music, as a just a fan of your work and just music in general, going to a show where you kind of I think my preference is a show like you did at Easton, even though I saw you, I think I might have seen you, it might have been 06 or 07. You can correct me. I think you might have been, it was in Chicago. And I was living in Chicago for when I was in grad school, when I was in theater school and stuff. And I'd seen you 06 or 07. You may have opened for Coldplay.
That's probably accurate, man.
Okay, you might have opened for
Yeah.
Coldplay, and then you did a smaller venue
Yeah,
with
exactly.
you and your band. I can't think of the venue. It wasn't the Double Door, because when I was talking to you after your show, it wasn't the Double Door, but that, like, you were
Yeah.
with your band and you crushed it and it was great. But I just think from I like that stripped down stuff better, because it's almost like you can appreciate the pros, like you can appreciate, like, even, I don't know, that's just a, I guess it's just a taste thing for me. But
No, I think that we could probably get into some science and get down to that being a fact, because I prefer the show too, and it's not it has nothing really to do with the fact that you can somebody can come on stage with 10, 20, 30, 40 people and present something that is dynamic and amazing. That it's just a completely different thing. To me, that you it's definitely comparing apples and oranges. I just personally know that when you can connect with people, it's one, it's easier if you're just by yourself and they are a part of an audience that is, but it's also they're also within their own little world, even within the audience. So you're connecting one on one with them. There's not much else for them to pay attention to. And you get to experience all those same things you would experience with the band, but you have to share that with the band, that perspective. Now it's just me, it's just the audience, and it's much more gratifying in that way.
Yeah, 'cause it's just like it's just you up there and your stuff. It's you and the music, and it's just I think most of the artists that I've really appreciated that have released projects, like their debut projects in the early 2000s and beyond, when I've seen them live, it's been my best favorite experiences have been just them by themselves, or them like stripped down or unplugged. And
Yeah.
you were almost, the interesting thing that happened that night, you were about to talk, I think you were about to talk about politics or something, and one of some middle-aged white woman was like, just play the music. I was like, ugh. And I was like, she's kind of cheating us from having a fuller experience, because I don't know what you were about to say something, and then you were just like, all right. And then you just played.
Yeah, what it really wasn't like to me, I was just pressing on the boundaries of the audience, and I would have gone back to that point I was about to make, because obviously the media has made Trump the biggest name in the world, and so you can just drop that name anywhere and just it elicits this reaction that I think that is makes very good material, when you're up on stage. And so that doesn't frighten me in any way, and actually the places where it does frighten me, it's kind of titillating. So I enjoy that. I want the banter, and I think that that's important, because it's the only way to move from one thing to the next in a society, is through wrestling with people and finding out what they're about. So I actually appreciated her comment, and I knew where it was coming from. As someone who probably feels one responsible, maybe even embarrassed for the current politics. You know what I mean? And so of course, you come there to hear a show and be kind of a fly on the wall. You don't want it to suddenly become the dinosaur in the room,
Yeah, but it's at the same time, it's just like, well, let's see what this guy that I like his music, let's see what he has to say about something else. You're not just a jukebox. I remember
And
listening you 'cause you what's your I was list just like going over your catalog you know, prepping to talk to you. And then your Troubadour record, like, I think you were in between, like, you were about to transition into another song. Mm-hmm. And then someone was like, play this. And you're like, what is this, a jukebox? Obviously, right. Like, obviously, I will have, like, songs that I want a person to sing. And I was just like, if he does, I would like him to do Blood from a Heart of Stone. But yeah. if he does Hot Stage Lights, and I'm good. And you open, you basically open with that. So. Yeah. But I was just, you know, like, yeah.
I'm the kind of person that, you know, like I said, when if I'm watching basketball, dude, I could watch the Lakers practice.
Yes.
You
know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah.
I could watch a boxer spar, you know, mm-hmm. in the gym by himself.
Right.
Because out there, the things that I'm looking for are within those elements. It's
sure.
It's much more of a stripped down version of that sport, you know.
Right.
So when a person's on stage. Like I don't care whether they want to go into their views on politics, or it's a up-tempo funk song or a slow song. I want to get that aspect of them. And my favorite people have always been the entertainers who put themselves in everything that they do.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why the whole kind of shtick where you're kind of selling this whole production aspect of your thing, you know, so many artists outgrow that.
Right.
Because it in itself is not artistic. It's a presentation, a tool you use to sell yourself. And so once you start relying upon that a little too much, then we move away from the artistry. And that's not a judgment on people who do that. It's just an acknowledgement of what is happening, which is the art is getting lost in the presentation.
Yeah, and I think because I've been acting since I was a kid, and I've been doing stand up for like 10 years.
Yeah.
And one thing that like I've been finding for me is the more that I grow as a person, and the more that I evolve as a stand up. It's sort of like I'm trying to get away from the material and just get to the point where you, I don't know, you may have had this playing where mm-hmm. it's just like you get to this, it's almost like if you're in the zone mm-hmm. and you're not really on book, you're off script, and yeah. you and this thing, this like Nirvana thing happens yeah. and you're just like, you know, like I'll talk to my friends like, I was just talking to him, dude. Like I killed it, but I was just talking to him. Mm-hmm. Like there are no jokes.
Yeah.
And it was just like, because I had done a show, I did like 3 shows last weekend, and I was trying to work on this one bit about like how, like, about show business, but I'm worried that it's too inside baseball.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to bring it like to talk about a person that's been canceled that like yeah. for a long time.
Yeah.
That should be, but at the same time, I feel an empathy for that person.
Yeah,
and I'm trying to like deal with this big complex thing and just whittle it down. Like mm-hmm. some nights it kills, some nights people are like, "What is this? What is this guy talking about?" And then I was just like, "Oh God!" And so it's kind of like that process to me is fun.
Yeah,
but at the same time, it's just frustrating. Do you ever go through that? Like when you're in the process of like making a song, are you just like, how am I going to conquer this beast, this puzzle?
Well, you know, my from my end of it, you know, from thought to paper to pen, mm-hmm. like that while that can get involved and it's very dynamic, it's really easy.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I don't have any much that's in the way.
But okay.
When you start talking about getting at a place where your world is now colliding with several hundred worlds inside of a venue, it's a completely different thing. That's why stand-up is also one of my favorite things to view, because, oh man, as Dax Shepherd says, you know, everybody's living and dying with you.
Yes,
you
know, yeah.
From joke to joke.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a, oh man, it's so titillating, because you're like, this is amazing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've seen what had to be one of the worst performances for a stand-up comedian ever at the Ha Ha Club in North Hollywood.
Okay.
I mean, not a single laugh.
Wow.
I mean, the audience largely didn't even respond. Like they couldn't even summon up the energy to boo.
Yeah.
And I laughed. It was so fucking funny and just titillating. Like I laughed, and I thoroughly enjoyed this person trying to navigate this hellhole. You know what I mean? So I totally love that. And that to me, and I told them after their set, like that is what it's about. Like there is no greater performance to me, because there's so much to get from that. And I hoped that they got from that, because it was a fantastic learning experience about, you know, testing the boundaries of the audience. Because the truth is, you know, there's no real fail in this society. I mean, mm-hmm. we can set up rules and tell people that they're failures because they don't have money to pay for homes,
right,
and all of that. But none of that is really real, no matter how much it actually impacts your life. And I'm not trying to trivialize that.
Sure.
I know life can become hellish.
Oh yeah.
But none of that is honestly real. That's just something that's been set in motion by a group of people who are largely in control. You know, but the fact that someone like a Michael Jackson or Bill Cosby or whomever you want to name mm-hmm. can be both victim and villain,
right.
That's a fact.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you can't escape that. You're not going to, you know, just toss that away just because you're going to throw somebody in jail or talk about them after death or whatever it is. None of that matters. The fact is, everybody can be both a victim and a villain. At the same time, spontaneously, you know what I mean? Because that's what life is, from the beginning to the end. Your past, your future, it all works together. It's all happening.
Did that comic acknowledge that he or she was bombing?
No,
see,
not
that's
at all.
See, that's the part. I think that's the part that's missing. Like, was it a guy or a girl?
A guy.
No, so if he, well, guys usually have a hard time doing that shit.
I know.
With this, so much bravado and so much just.
And the guy was African.
Was African good. Guy. Oh,
was
man.
So good, man.
It's weird.
He had no idea. He was totally like belligerent. Like, I don't care if y'all laugh or not.
Yeah, see, that's that. So you got to say, this is, hey, this isn't working. This isn't. I did a show, and I talked about this on the last episode I posted, but I did this show, which is a really fun and interesting show. It's a show that they call Shtick a Pole in it, and it's a stand up show in the East Village where you do stand up. There's like three or four comics, and there's like three or four pole dancers, beautiful women that pole dance. And this past weekend, they were pole dancing to Aerosmith.
Okay.
And so these people, these hot girls, are pole dancing on stage, and then you do a set, and then if you say something, I was trying to do that joke. Mm-hmm. That I was telling you about, and they got really tight, and I was like, okay, let's move on to something else. I'll give you that was for me. I just need to see if this will work. I was like, that's for me. I'll give you something that I know is gonna work, and I'll get off stage, and I'll you know, and
bring back the pole dancer.
Yeah, bring back the dancer. So that's what happened. But it was frustrating to me that, you know, I was telling another comic, I was like, dude, like, you go, we're doing the show. It's fun. The hosts are great. The producers are awesome and everything. But you can't be puritanical on something that I say while you're watching these hot women pole dance.
What did you say that?
I didn't say that on stage. I should have.
That would have been the thing to say.
That would have been it. But I just realized I was just, you know, sometimes when you're in it, you're just like.
Of course.
I just acknowledged it. And I was just like, okay, yeah, I'm in the East Village. All right. I did say that on stage. And then I said, good night, guys.
Because if you, and I know that it's easy to say that, you know, this anything that this guy says is going to be fire because of the stature that he holds, mm-hmm. but that's the difference between Dave Chappelle now and Dave Chappelle 15 years ago.
Right, right.
Because he walks through those jokes.
Yeah.
And that awkwardness.
Mm-hmm.
And he walks himself and the audience through to the other side.
Right.
And they want to be walked through that. Just
right.
like when that lady said, just play music. I don't know where my head was at the time. I think actually I paid so little attention to what she said. I was actually paying attention to my son and my tour manager.
Okay.
And it being first night, you know, my thoughts were elsewhere. But I, had that been any other night, I probably would have walked her through that comment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because there's just so much material there.
Right. Because sometimes, because that's important, too. I think that you touched on something really important, because sometimes it is about just getting the job done.
Yeah.
And in some of those moments, it's like, I could go down this door, but mm-hmm. then it's like, I could get off stage and I could do my job and be effective at it.
Yeah.
But then sometimes, like, some moments there's time for growth. Like, and I think you being a seasoned artist, you just have to, you pick and choose that. And I think that's what I do sometimes. Like, I give it to myself to just say, like, I could just get on stage and get the check and
yeah,
and go home.
Yeah. And you know, I've certainly done that before, man. But those some of those nights when I've made that choice have been some of the most disappointing.
Really?
In my career. Things that, you know, I regretted for years.
Yeah.
Having made that choice. When I'm in those moments, though, and Easton wasn't one of them, you know, I kind of wish I'd, you know, followed up on that lady's comment, but I knew that there were so many other opportunities to do something. Like,
yeah.
I she was just nipping at my ankles. Like, that didn't even mean much to me at all.
Sure.
But man, I love those. I live for those moments. And it's particularly after this tour, and everything went so well. And I was determined to connect with the audience in that way, because I was just like, if I'm going to come back and do this, I got to do it my way.
Right, right.
Not James Brown or Prince or anybody else's way.
Yeah, I think that's important, too. I think it's like, because that's what I say all the time, like, especially doing stand up, when it's just like, you, I was like, if you don't do this bit, you're why are you even here?
Yeah.
If you don't try to take the risks, because I'm gonna, I've said this for, I need to, this fall I'm looking to record my first album.
Oh, good, man.
Yeah, and I'm just kind of in the mode of, like, I'm kind of tired of this material, and I'm kind of I need to just get it out there, and it's most likely gonna be independent.
Okay.
And so it's just sort of like, I'm at the point where there's parts of it that I feel like I'm tired of, but then it's almost like I'm not, it's never really done.
Yeah.
And I think it's a perfect time to even though I would like to probably mention this later in the conversation, but you just released a reimagining of your first album, your self-titled debut.
Yeah.
And it made me think, like, it's almost like, cause I know, coming from the theater, you and like working on shows and stuff, it's never really done. The show might close, but like you and I might be in a run. Let's say we're in a run of like Top Dog, Underdog, this Susan Laurie Parks play, two man play, and you and I are doing our thing. Closing night, you say a line that I've heard for 6 months or so, but you say it differently.
Yeah,
and then it affects me in a different way, and the play becomes something else.
Right.
You know, and it's just like, fuck, well, I wish we had another couple nights to see what that was about.
Yeah.
And then it closes. And so, like, with your album, which the self-titled, I don't know, like, I guess, I don't know how I want to approach this, but let's just talk about Trim first. Talk about Trim and how you came to what was the germ that built you, you know, putting this out and creating this project, which is great.
Funny thing, you mentioned the play and the scenario where somebody says the same line they've been saying for months, and they said it in a way where it just hits you that night. And it's not necessarily because they said it differently, although they may have, but it's now you're hearing it differently.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And again, if you haven't guessed already, like, I'm into science. And I think it's a great way, real science, I think it's a great way to understand the environment. Quite frankly, much of the public is ignorant to, for lack of a better word.
Sure.
But I said that to say, when I approached these songs, all bullshit aside, my manager was just like, "Yo, you should do a 15th anniversary, thing where you cut, recut those songs." And he was just asking me to do it strictly for business. Like he was like, "These songs are kind of tied up with, the major labels. Maybe if you recut them, it'll be easier for us to kind of license them, make some money with them, do whatever." So he was approaching it completely from that position, right? For me, it was just a challenge. I was like, oh, okay. It was a step, a place to go. Again, like I said, coming out of a relationship, just starting to tour again after 6 years, I just needed to take steps. So I was like, okay, I'll do that. So I dove in, and immediately, I don't remember the first song. It might have been Hurt December, it might have been Who Will Love Me and When That I started with. And it blew my mind because those words were explaining the aftermath of my life. The 15 years that I just spent, what I mean? And it was crazy to me. And I was like, cause I didn't think much of that first record. Not that I don't like it. It's just, it's 15 years ago. I was,
Different
whatever.
guy.
Yeah. But man, that those lyrics actually meant something to me. They were helping me. And so I did not expect that at all. And that was the real fabric that ran through the recording of those songs. The recording is what it is. I hope people like it. But for me to it let me know that this wasn't about me. I was driven to be the person that I am. And that's comforting in a way to know that, there's a force out there that kind of just ushers all of this into place. And I don't have to, always feel like I'm in control, because in fact, I'm not. And so it was very, very comforting and humbling, but also, I didn't use this word five times already, but titillating.
Well, it's interesting because I was listening to to Highlights, and then I went back the just the original the original version, and then I went to Trim, and it seemed like those two the version the new version seemed like you were more weathered, like and like it was just sort of like the original was just like, did I mean anything to you? Like, what did I even mean? Like, it was like you're a younger guy. Like, hey, what's did I was were you just acting? What was this? Was this was all just bullshit? And then it the, then the new you know on Trim, it's just like, okay, this is probably what happened. Maybe did I? You know, sort of like it was more reflective, and it seemed like,
Exactly, man. The first time when I recorded that song, it was really just a young writer, brash, almost approaching it from the position of the guy, who's telling the girl like, I'm asking, but it's not really, it's a rhetorical question, like, whatever. You need to get your life together, whatever. This was fine, but cool, okay. And it's over. This time I was completely the victim. You know what I mean? Totally asking a very, very heartened question, like, what did this mean? Because I just spent this time doing this, so I was it was a complete reversal of roles, singing it this time, and the words meant something to me. They helped me.
And it seemed like, because with your writing, it you don't like you what I appreciate about like the your writing in general, but with respect to the first two albums, it seemed like you kind of spoke to something like you kind of you have the braggadocio of the guy where I'm the ladies man and I get the girls, we're doing this and that, but then you also say, well, this I was wounded by this. This thing, this hurt me, this was that, and I was, but and then even on some of those songs where you're like my probably my favorite song, I don't know, God, it's kind of a tie, but and maybe it's cliche where you hear most of your fans, they'll say, being a girl, Hot Stage Light is probably that record's probably my favorite, because it's sort of like the second verse where you say, I don't love her as much as I want to own her and then let her go. It's like, yeah, did you really like this girl? Were you really in love with her? Or were you just like the idea of her and you wanted to possess, you wanted to possess her? It's like, and just the poetry of like the first stanza, like all the men in her life, you know, they hung up, posterized like dead heroes. Like, yeah. Fuck. Like, you start the song that way. And it's almost like, it's just like, this, she's a man eater. Like, you're saying this woman is a man eater, and I'm not going to let her get me.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm the man of the year. You know what I mean? But yeah. Then if she, and then, you know, you take her to the, like, I'm telling you about the song you wrote, but it's like, fuck. But then it's like, this chick, like, okay, this chick is a monster, but yeah. Then it's like, I'm an asshole. And you said, like, you put it on yourself where it's like, today, I your love, tomorrow, the world, wish I could stay, but I'm looking for more. And it's just like, maybe this, you know, it is what it is, but I don't know. Yeah. I just like that. I like that juxtaposition of, like you said, being the victim and the, what is it? You said the victim
and the villain.
And the villain. So. Yeah. I think that kind of, that's like one of the things I appreciate about your work.
No, man, I appreciate that, seriously, because I'm coming at this, like I just told you about being driven. Mm-hmm. I'm coming at this almost as lost as the listener.
Yeah.
It's always been that way. The songs, you know, I try to meet the songs, but the songs are meeting me as well.
Okay.
These are ideas that I would argue largely come in form.
Yeah.
And I just have to kind of pull them through my thought process into a materialization. And so that's essentially my role in all of this. And when the song gets there, I'm just as thrilled and excited as a listener would be. That's what makes me even more excited when somebody like yourself gets into the lyric, yeah, and tells me their interpretation of it.
Right.
Because no matter what they say, it's always a similar kind of thing. No, even though the words are different.
Yeah.
And even, you know, to somebody else, if they heard you describing Hot Stage Lights, they might say, oh, that's probably not what he meant. Or whatever. Yeah. But it's exactly what I meant, even though it's a different kind of terminology.
Yeah. Okay. Because I'm just like putting that like on it. Just that's what it, that to me just like was what I got from it. And then, you know, I was 26 when I heard this album. So I'm a guy. When I first get a hold of your music, I'm in my 20s, yeah, like trying to figure shit out. So I'm really like, when I count going away to college, like I went away to college, but I was only an hour and a half away.
Gotcha.
Like my mom could do my laundry if I brought it home.
Yeah.
So I would take me being 22 years old, moving to, you know, I'm from the Maryland, D.C. area, moving to Chicago, and really being on my own. I still had the support of my parents and everything, but that was the first time that I had my own apartment. I had jobs. I was working. I was meeting different women and like, oh, this girl, like, because I have my closest friend since first grade loves you. Like, we both love your work. And we would talk about like, yeah, she's trying to do me like they did Van Hunt in that record. You know, like, she wouldn't call me back. She just texted me like her thoughts in prose, like, you're just gonna fucking, you know. So it's just like, so when your first album came out, I kind of want to talk a little bit about your time when you were in Atlanta, like working with, like, you're a studio guy, like producing records, like with Dallas Austin, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, you were, so when your first album came out, how old were you?
Oh, when it came out, I was almost 34.
Okay. So you were like, so you're 10 years older than me. I kind of want to talk about that. One of the things I think why it worked for me, because, like, you were already, most people when they come out now, it just seems like within the last decade or so, mm-hmm, or even before that, like when people come out, like any type of artist, no, whatever genre, like, mm-hmm, they're kind of young.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like you watch them grow, you watch their ascent, you watch their decline. You were already a grown ass man when this album comes out.
Yeah.
And it was, it seems that way because, and then like a full-fledged musician, because revisiting this stuff, like, because when I first heard it, I was like, this guy's really good. And I'm just like, this guy makes good music. And, but like listening to it, trying to be more critical,
yeah,
it just seemed like the records are all like robust sonically. They're like intricate and complicated, but not pretentious, but just like there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know and what I mean?
I think in defense of some of it, and you know, I came up in an era where we were just coming out. Mm-hmm. The industry, the music industry at least, was on a steep decline.
Mm-hmm.
But there was still enough breath left there where I could attach myself to someone like a Randy Jackson.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
And receive an education, basically, mm-hmm. about how to be an artist, how to make records. And now you see, and artists were, you know, have always come out and been young. I mean, you can look at Stevie Wonder and Prince.
Right.
But the place where they came from, Stevie Wonder and Prince, was a completely different kind of school.
Right.
I mean, you're talking about somebody who basically came out of the pinnacle of the music industry.
Mm.
And so when Stevie you know, Stevie had a greatest hits album before he was 21.
Mm.
And Prince hits the scene, and you know, he's got Stevie and Sly and Earth, Wind & Fire to sit there and study. I mean, immediate peers.
Yeah.
And so his level matched my level at his level at 17, 18 matched my level at 30, 31, because it took me that long to get where he was. That's the fall off from the industry. I just didn't have the same kind of place where I could, you know, we had just gone through hip hop, and you can argue that hip hop came out of a place where that was near apocalypse, you know,
yeah,
in terms of American urban dwelling. So all of that kind of plays its role. And now, you know, kids are coming out, they're artists, they're young, but man, the music doesn't have the same, no offense to them, but it doesn't have the same kind of depth, because that's just not where they came out of. Everything has been thinned out
mm-hmm.
through mass production of their culture and of their thoughts, and everything has to be very simplistic.
Mm-hmm.
And try as they might, and many of them do, to pour some complexity back into it.
Yeah,
there's still this the undergirding of their artistic statement is so thin,
right?
You know, because that kind of matches where the culture is. Mass production does that, though. It's not just them. You know,
I said about your work, I mean it as a credit, because it's inspiring to me.
No, I appreciate that. All I'm saying is I was 34 when my first record comes out,
mm-hmm.
and it's on, I would argue, it's on par with where Prince was when his first record came out. But there was a 17-year difference between the two of us.
Right. And it takes longer for some people. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm saying it took me longer to get where he was.
Yeah, sure. Of course.
Of the
yeah.
fall off in the industry.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That was my schooling, just took that much longer to get to that point, to be honest, where he was or where Stevie was. It was just a different time, man.
Yeah, because I get it sometimes from like stand up, because I started when I was 29 and I was in a place like creatively where I had left Chicago, where I was a working actor, like doing a lot of plays and stuff like that. And then moving mm-hmm. here, not knowing anybody and trying to figure stuff out, doing community theater, shit like that. And then saying I wanted to do stand up for the longest time. But I just suppressed it. I think I'd seen somebody get booed on Showtime at the Apollo, and I was like, I'm not doing that. but then it just came to a point where I had to come out. Like, it's almost like coming out of the closet. Like, I'm a stand-up. And so it's just like I have to, you know, investigate that. And that was a time for me. But I would say when I started, I'm not famous or anything, but I get a little work, Van. You know, I do mm-hmm. all right. And I feel like I'm on the path that I'm supposed to be on. But right away when I started, I could definitely see myself separate from people that had been doing it a little longer. That and that's kind of like being a man, being 29 or 30 years old, and having something to say, having been abused by time a little bit, and being a little weathered. Because I didn't realize that. Because that's like one of the reasons why I look at you. I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, but like I liked Stevie Wonder. I thought Prince was great. I'm not an aficionado, but I'm able to recognize his influence in guys like you. Especially like On the Jungle Floor was like when it seemed to come in full bloom. I want to get back to that later, but like it was sort of that thing where it's like, okay, this guy has something to say. It's just like it only came with me reinvestigating, like looking back at this first album, was like, oh, this guy was, he was in his 30s. He knew what the fuck he was talking about. Like, there's like, there's failure. There's like dysfunctional relationships, like down here in hell, and you know, all this stuff. So it made me appreciate this album more. So I kind of want to talk a little bit about like what was your life like leading up to that. So like in 96, you had the placement with, you know, Dion Ferris with Love Jones. Was that like one of the first markers of like a big thing happening for you artistically or in the business?
It was. I guess you could say it was one of the first. It was certainly the one that came with the most prestige.
Right. You know? Right.
But you know, there were several things that happened before that. Dion picking me to be in her band.
Okay. Yeah.
And that was the first time I had gone on tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so
what was that like for you? The first time?
Oh, it was wild, man. It was, you know, then I was, you know, I actually was young. It was probably 23.
Okay.
Something like that. 23, 24. And so just wilding out, just bugging, you know. You know, with being on the road, going to different countries.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just, it was a crazy experience and a lot of fun. I enjoyed being on the road with those folks, with that band. David Ryan Harris was in that band and taught me a lot about guitar.
Yeah.
That's where I met Randy. You know, everything just kind of blossomed from there, and as well as meeting Dallas, you know, who gave me opportunities as well. And he had a singer he was producing named Joy.
Yes, yeah.
And she was, you know, really, really helpful. NDRE also helpful. You know, just it was good to meet them. Atlanta was an interesting place then, and then all of a sudden, you know, boom, we had the hit with Hopeless.
Yes,
and then of course it was off and running from then.
Mm-hmm. So were you just Hopeless hits? What was your job like working with Dallas? Like you were just, what were you producing records and stuff?
Yeah, I was kind of the guy. He I think he was trying to figure me out too.
Okay,
just the guy he brings in to kind of lend some complexity to it.
Okay,
to
sure.
The productions, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
A level of sophistication. I think he always, to his credit, saw what I could do before everybody else.
Okay.
But didn't really know. And he even said this much, he just didn't think the market was ready for it. Not the full breadth of what I could do.
So are we talking late 90s?
Yeah, well, mid to late 90s.
Mid to late, okay.
And so he was just trying to pick off little pieces that he thought he could, pieces of my work that he thought he could kind of, you know, sell.
Sure.
That was the right instinct, I think, looking back on it, even though it was frustrating for me.
Yeah.
And so, but finally, you know, he had caused enough ruckus out there, you know, by throwing my name around that, you know, people became interested.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how the record deal came about.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the first record that you did for this album, for Van Hunt, the self-titled?
It was probably it was definitely Who Will Love Me and Win It.
Oh, okay.
I wrote that actually when I was 24, 25.
Okay.
Yeah, and so that record just kind of hung around.
All right. So you were basically writing songs as you were just touring and just living. You're just constantly writing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And then they say the deals here now put these songs together.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, like Who Will Let Me Winter Down Here and Hell With You? Like, but those are all done between 95 and 97, 98.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Even Character, a song that actually appeared on my second album, mm-hmm. that was done around the same time.
Now, see, Character, I know this is it's the second album, but Character is one of those records where I feel like when we talk about stuff being stripped down, like, I think after you did, like, that Popular Machine EP that came out,
mm-hmm.
like, that stripped down version, that was, mm-hmm. like, that was, like, the time where I started to be like, holy shit. Like, that's the perfect example of a song that's, like, that's just, like, it's even more compelling stripped down than it is the way it lives on the jungle floor, you know?
Well, funny story about that is the way it's stripped down was the way I cut it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. But it, you know, I had a producer on the jungle floor.
Uh-huh.
And so he kind of shaped the song to what it became on that album.
Okay.
But I immediately started going back to the way that I had always played it, which by the time the album came out, been almost 8 years, I had been playing it since 98, the way you heard it on the stripped down version.
Yeah.
So that was the way I always played it. I rarely ever actually, other than like television shows or something, I rarely played that song the way it sits on the album.
Cause that was that Tonight Show set?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I played the album version.
Okay, yeah, because it's great. Like, it's a good record, but it's just like, I think, like, with an artist like you, it just kind of fares better. Like, even some of my favorites, like, within my listeners know, like, an artist like Rachel Yamagata, Annie Clark, St. Vincent, when they do some of these stripped down performances, it's just like, oh yeah, there's real poetry in this. You know, like, yeah. Kind of like when you see, not all the time, but like when you see watch a Tiny Desk concert, like on, yeah. It's just kind of like, oh, all right, there's more there than I thought it was, but you know, so it's just like, oh, this is actually compelling. This isn't just background music.
And frankly, that is the real robustness of design.
Mm.
You know, when you really come with the craftsmanship.
Yeah.
You don't have to say very much. In fact, even if you've said a lot, part of the finishing of the piece is to begin pulling back things so that those most essential parts of it can shine. So a song like you just said with Character, it only needs a certain few things,
mm-hmm.
to be articulated for that the real essence of that song to pop.
Yeah.
And you know, I knew that in 2006, but I probably couldn't, didn't feel I could have articulated that to the guy who was producing the record, the importance of it. And who knows, he might have listened and gone with,
yeah.
you know, my original version,
mm-hmm.
you know, so, and you know, like you said, I mean, the album version is cool.
Yeah.
It's certainly funky, but that was never the point of that song.
Right.
And the point was it's probably better supported by the way I had always played it.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because it makes me think, and I'm kind of going to jump to, because since it seems like we're on this topic, like a record mm-hmm. like Feelings from Popular, like mm-hmm. how do you know when to add, when to take away? Like, because it's like you're this great musician and you have these superpowers. How do you know when to just be like, oh, this needs a trumpet? Because I was listening to Feelings this morning, and I was like, and I think maybe the second or third stanza, the horns come in. I'm like, fuck, you know what I mean? You know, it's just, it's light. It's not even heavy. It's just like, oh shit. And I'm not a musician. So I'll tell you, I'm not a musician, but I just know like, oh, this sounds good. So like, that as an example, like, how do you know, like, when to do that?
But see, you know, that's the same thing you use when you're listening to it, and the things you get excited about are the same things that any musician should use when coming up with the song.
Ah.
Because, you know, music is a theory.
Mm-hmm.
Sound is sound. Sound exists outside of music theory.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're listening to something, you could be outside in nature.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You hear something and then you'll hear another layer of something, another layer of something. Those things begin to kind of work together in different ways. You know, but it's not until you get into a studio where somebody's like, oh, okay, let's set up some rules
right
to how we're going to do this. And they only do that so they can get from, you know, point A to point B or whatever.
Yeah.
But the same, you know, the criteria I use when making a song is very simple. Like, what I come up, I had the beat and the keyboard to Feelings.
Yeah.
And my guitarist at the time, George Gordon, he also plays trumpet, and he responded to that song. He was like, man, can I take this home and work on some trumpet? And he was, you know, so serious about it. I was like, hell yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he came up with a very tasteful thing because the song meant something to him.
Yeah.
And he just simply wanted to express on it. And it was a much better and more gratifying a result, because, you know, rather than going out and just paying somebody to add some trumpet onto it, you know what I mean? So he added that, and it was what he felt.
You
know what I mean? And it worked.
Yeah. And then I'm also a sucker for horns, because I remember, like, even like this one club I work at, they let you pick on your walk on music. And I used this record by one of my favorite rappers named Blue, and he had this record called Fresh Out, and he just the horns are just like ba da ba 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 da ba ba. I was like, yeah, I got to come out to that. and then the other comments were like, oh, I love that song. Your set was all right, but I love that song. They didn't say that, but they're just saying like, I love that song. I was like, yeah, those horns, man, I love those horns. Yeah, so. I think that's something, because it seems like with I'm trying to remember, I think I did take a note of this, like, I think it might have been Her December, which to me sounded like, it was like Her December, like, kind of starts, it's almost like it's an overture, like, mm-hmm. when I think of like musical theater, like they'll play like a couple of the songs that you're gonna hear, like, before the show. Yeah. When I think, like, it's just like, I just noticed like some robustness in that song, where it was just sonically, where it was just like, fuck, that's great. It was just like, that album is so rich musically. Like, you do a great job of like melding like the complicated like nature of the music and then the lyrics and stuff. And it made me think about, like, because there's another artist with, like, there's a, I don't know if how familiar you are with Saint Vincent, but
like
this record she does, what is it? I think Paris is Burning, and like those are the two of the, like, I was just like, where it starts off like again with horns, or like maybe like, and it's just like, and then it builds into something else, and it's just like, that's kind of what I felt when I listened to Her December, like, again, like. It's just like a quality that you have that, I don't know, man. It's like grown up stuff. Cause I think like my background, you know, I listened to my dad's music, you know, the Curtis Mayfield, Marvin Gaye, Smokey, all those guys, love them. They're icons and everything like that. But I don't remember really noticing, like, I'm going to make this assumption that when you're recording these albums, are you using a live band for most of those records?
Well, I bring them in. Sometimes it's a room full of musicians. Sometimes I'm bringing them in one at a time. Sometimes it's just me.
Okay, yeah. Because it seems like they're people you're with on at least some of the records. Like, you're with other people. And I was thinking about this stuff that I listened to in high school. You know, I was like an R&B guy, but it was just like, you know, Kenny Lattimore. I don't know. Who else was I listening to? I was like, I like those R&B dudes, because I think most comedians, if they were honest, they kind of want to be a rock star. And sometimes rock stars and musicians want the opposite. They want to be comics too.
Yeah.
So I think that's why there's always like this mutual appreciation between comedians and musicians. But it was sort of like, where the hell was I going with this? When you think, I was listening to these guys, and I don't remember really hearing like live instrumentation on a lot of those records. Mm-hmm. Maybe like Tony's like House of Music, that album, that's Still a Man record, where it's like, oh, I did have some taste when I was younger. I feel like I did anyway. Like the stuff that I listened to, I think I was a little ahead of the curve, but I remember like just thinking about that, and I was like, okay, that Still a Man record, that was like something. And then I really don't remember being hit in the head, mm-hmm. like really knocked out, until I heard Voodoo from D'Angelo.
Gotcha.
And I'm thinking like, so this was, I was 20 years old, so that comes out in 2000. I'm like, okay, there were definitely people in the room making this music.
Yeah. Right.
And so like, I kind of like, even though I loved your first album, like mm-hmm. On the Jungle Floor, like fucking knocked me out, because I think I was at the age where I could understand like and appreciate like what was being done, what you put out there. Yeah. So it was just sort of like, I don't know, like that one, On the Jungle Floor. Like I said, a couple weeks before I had seen you in Easton, like I talked for about your music for like 10 or 15 minutes, and just saying like, oh yeah, like when you had announced your tour.
Oh yeah.
And I said like, On the Jungle Floor was pretty much like, that's a desert. Like if you're trapped on a desert, I at least have to have this one.
Yeah.
And I just think from like top to bottom, it's got everything, man. It's
man,
like,
I appreciate that.
Yeah, man. It's just like, I'm looking at these records, I'm looking at the track list right now, and then we have to talk about it. So I don't care. I'm gonna be that guy that's like, okay, sometimes when I have musicians on the show, when I'm lucky to have folks like you on the show, I kind of do this thing called Anatomy of a Song.
Okay.
Where you kind of just like, you know how I think the New York Times does this thing called, or Sundance does a thing called Anatomy of a Scene, where they mm-hmm. break down what's going on. Can we do that with being a girl?
Of course. Yeah, man.
I think that kind of encapsulates like, I don't know, man. It just encapsulates a lot about my life. And okay. I think it made me think about like, just like this, how complicated women are. And then like, you can't really be mad, because I think this is something, I think it's an important song in this day and age, because it made me think like in my 20s, where it's like, yeah, it happens to everybody. You get your heart, everybody gets their heart broken by a woman. But mm-hmm. at the same time, you can't be bitter about it.
Yeah.
And I think nowadays where we have words like toxic masculinity to define, you know, the behavior of what guys do, like the negative stuff. It's like, I think that's something that, like, looking back, that's something that kind of made me like a lot less bitter than I could be.
Got you. Yeah,
and so I think that on that level, like, it's important. But just as a song and the lyricism, like, can we talk about that? How did you come up with this thing?
Well, if I remember correctly, like, I had the music for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I put together a little track, and I knew that I really liked the track and that it was going to need something kind of succinct lyrically to kind of bring it home.
Yeah.
So I'm talking to one of my girlfriends, and I mean, literally, like, she's a friend who's a girl.
Sure.
And she was like, you know, we were talking about fake orgasms.
Mm.
And so she said something that kind of brought out the lyric, where I said, the fact is,
she's an actress using the bedroom for practice. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's where it started. That was the germ, the germination process, demarcation for
sure.
that song.
Yeah.
And it just grew from there, where I had a concept and I already had a track. So it was kind of easy to then focus on the poetry,
mm-hmm.
And allow the song to kind of grow from there. So that was the only song on the album, maybe with the exception of Priest of Police, where the guy who produced the record largely left it alone, largely left the demo alone.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And so that song, as you hear it, other than the strings, was exactly what I brought to the table. And so it was able to, you know, live through that kind of organic process.
Now, when you write something like a line like at the initial plan, she's making plans to build her a man, like a T-Ford or an aeroplane. The girl wants a model romance. Do you ever write something, when you wrote that, were you like, I'm going to kill him with this shit? Do you ever think that when you're writing stuff?
I do, but I'm not sure that anybody has ever responded to the same lines that I thought was so genius.
Okay. You know? Because that shit, like when I heard that, I was like, fuck. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, no. Oh my God. Like,
No, see, that line just kind of came out. And, you know, like, even with a line like From Down Here in Hell With You, where it's like, I think of saving myself, but with nothing to complain about up in heaven, what I do. Like, those kinds of lines scare me. So I was
why does it scare you? Talk about it.
I didn't know if I wanted, you know, like my mom to hear me say something that alluded to the fact that I didn't have the same respect for religion or spirituality that she did, you know, and that I could kind of toy with the idea of it in a song.
Yeah.
So that scared me. And yet, you know, people gravitate toward that line. And
then
a line like the one you just called out, From Being a Girl, like I just spit that out. That was just a collection of thoughts, and I synthesized them.
Yeah.
And spit it out. Didn't even really mean that much to me, to be honest.
That's like Ricky Bobby. I piss excellence. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, man. That's a.
But then the lines that I'm like, oh my God, that was genius. Like, nobody ever responds.
Like, which ones? Which one? Give me one. Give me one from.
I'd have to really think on it, man.
Okay.
Really,
okay.
Pull it out, but there are some, I can guarantee you, and nobody's ever been like, oh man, woo, that line.
Because that's good. That's good to know. Because it is because you kind of think like, I was thinking like, damn, like that. Because you think about like, it's easy. I think it's easy to access when you're listening to hip hop.
Yeah,
and it's sort of like, oh shit, he killed him with that line, or they made a certain reference or something.
Yeah.
But like with like music, like with just like soul music, or, you know, just kind of like, wow. Like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh, man, I'm really sorry. Can we pause the podcast for just a second, bro?
Sure, sure.
I just got somebody at the door. I'm
sure.
Be right back.
All right. Yep.
Yeah, sorry about that, man.
Oh, it's all good, man. Life happens.
Busy day right here with, you know, landscape folks and delivery people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I forgot where we were.
We were just talking about like just the your amazing lyrics. Yeah, man. Like it's one of those things I always wondered, like when you think about stuff like this. So like with On the Jungle Floor, like so you had Character. What was the other single? Being a Girl and Character?
Exactly.
And it was just two singles?
Yep, two official singles.
Okay.
Yeah, I always pushed them for Priest of Police and At the End of a Slow Dance, but I'm not sure those ever really became official singles, and I'm not really sure how serious the label was at that point of really trying to push a single from that album.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were, you know, quite satisfied with just going with the critical acclaim.
Sure.
And moving from there, but you know, another thing about On the Jungle Floor is that I went through two processes of demoing, because when I started that record, I was producing it myself. And then the label jumped in, much like they did with their first record, and just kind of interjected themselves, and were like, no, we want this guy to produce with you or whatever. And so having to go through the process all over again with demos and stuff, it gave me an opportunity to step back and say, okay, I want to focus on the poetry of this album. And so I really dug in on the lyric of across the board on that album.
Yeah, 'cause it definitely showed in this one, and it's just
Thank
not
you.
it's not it's just like evolution. It's not like it just showed on this one, and I'm sure I can go back and pull any one of those tracks from the first one and be like, "Yeah, that's great too." But it just seemed like it just I was just kind of just gobsmacked as a listener, because I think there's really been only two soul albums that have kind of just done that to me, and it was just like it was this one and it was Voodoo, like just
Oh.
as far as like just all together. And I think that's just like my brain finally getting to figure some shit out, you know,
Yeah.
just or
No, but thank you though, man. Seriously.
yeah, because. And then you had, I think, wasn't If I Take You Home in that movie with Sanaa Lathan, Something New?
Yeah, exactly.
Was that, so that was, so you had a place, you had that. Was there other stuff that came from this one? Any, just a critical acclaim?
Well, there's always been a really good critical acclaim that's followed me throughout my career.
Yeah.
That movie was Meeting Someone New was directed by Sena Hamri, who also did my Dust video. So we had a working relationship
Oh, okay.
already, and so when she started making films, she just reached out to me and started picking songs,
Okay.
and so I've been lucky in that way.
Okay, yeah. So what I guess what I want to talk about now, I want to kind of go back to which I thought was a great interview you did with Dax Shepard. On the Armchair Expert, you mentioned something that I think was really important when you were talking about before On the Jungle, before the first album came out, you were at a table, you and Randy, I guess you and Randy Jackson,
Yeah.
with all these executives, and you had like they were the like black was it like Black College Radio was trying to take one song and another
Oh
group.
yeah,
Talk
yeah,
Can you talk about that a little bit?
yeah. Well, yeah, I'm trying to see what would be a good point of origin,
Okay, yeah.
but basically, so I get the record deal, and when I walked into Capitol to sign that deal and to meet everybody, the staff, they had an incoming president, a new incoming president. And so he's also just beginning his relationships with the staff at the label, but he was the one who signed me. I was his first signing at the label. So
Okay.
this was a big deal. This was a time for the staff to show that they would support his decisions, So
Right.
there was a lot happening here,
Sure.
at this meeting. But I walked in with the album. I mean, much of what you hear on the first record is what I had when I walked in there. And so, but they had heard a few demos by the time I actually sat with them, Randy and I sat with them. So, I think that the black people on the staff immediately understood that they were going to have their songs that they could shop, and that everybody else were gonna take what they wanted to take and kind of shop and promote. And so immediately, Seconds of Pleasure was picked out by the black people in the room, who suddenly became the black department. You know what I mean? And everybody else who happened to be white, you know what I mean? Mostly. We're like, okay, well, we like Dust, you know what I mean? So it just immediately morphed. It was like the record caused segregation, where there might not have been any. I don't even
Martin
know.
or Seinfeld.
Yeah, exactly.
What was like, so, 'cause I'm trying to think. So the album comes out 2004,
Yeah.
and I'm just thinking from my perspective. So I was 24 at the time. I think I might have had an iPod for about a year.
Yeah.
So I was getting into like in undergrad, I had a radio show. And I would play like R&B soul stuff and you know, oh, I play that stuff. You just weren't. I didn't. I mean, you weren't out yet. I would have played. Yeah. I would have played your shit, obviously. But so I'm thinking around that time, I wasn't really learning about new artists from the radio.
Yeah.
And it would kind of be like through friends, internet stuff. And then you just kind of play the stuff that you liked in your dorm. And then I moved to Chicago, and that's more of a commuter town than being in the middle of nowhere, Maryland. So mm-hmm. I get this iPod, and I have control over what I'm listening to.
Yeah.
And I'm not listening to the radio. And I think I found out about you maybe in Entertainment Weekly.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. I think maybe you opened for Alicia Keys at some point, right? Or no? Am I right?
Well, no, but she was some of the earliest people I worked with.
Okay.
When I was writing and producing, and when my album came out, she had already had major success.
Okay.
And as a favor to me, you know, she told people that she liked me and my music and you know, the role that I had played in her early development.
Okay, because I remember working at Best Buy. I used to work in the music department and sell like DVDs and stuff and all that crap. And I remember, because I had read about you first, and then I saw the album. I was like, oh, that's the guy from Entertainment Weekly. And I bought the album with my employee discount. The listeners don't give a shit about this, but I'm just telling you.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it makes you feel good at some point. But I buy the album, and I was like, okay, this guy's great. And then, so that's how I found out about you. And so what I found interesting about that part of that conversation that you had with Dax was just like, okay, like, so where were they taking it? Were they taking it to just, were the black people taking Seconds of Pleasure to like just urban radio? Were the white people taking it? College radio?
Okay. They would be taking it to college radio. And the way it would work is for both roads are trying to get to the biggest terrestrial radio market they can find.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they both have to start off in a place where they can kind of test the market and then borrow a few dollars to then do further testing before they can see if it's worth it to spend the immense amount of money it is to hit a pop radio or a let's say pop R&B, you know, or certainly R&B hip hop.
Right.
Where you have these super large stations and it costs so much money to promote and get your songs played.
Yeah.
And so both roads started, you know, one Dust with College or AAA and Seconds of Pleasure with what they called, I think, adult contemporary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because maybe go ahead. I'm sorry.
And it only costs you, you know, like a Laker ticket.
to get
to song play.
Oh man. Well, man. Oh God. Showbiz.
Right.
Oh man. Cause I think maybe the last bastion of like finding out about music prior to the internet reigning supreme was VH1 Soul.
Yeah.
And so guys like you would come up on there. And so like cause you kind of mentioned there where you kind of like, I kind of know I'm in some. The road is gonna be different for you, like you acknowledged it even back then. You were just like, okay, this is not gonna be like John Legend or, I mean, he wasn't even out then, was he? Even out? He wasn't. Even
you know,
out.
He was. His song had just hit like right immediately before my album came out. His big song.
But you're not even like the same, like you're contemporaries, but you're not the same artist.
And I know that, and I knew that then.
Yeah.
But what I also knew is that those differences surface as the money becomes more immense. You know what I mean? So as more money is spent, the investment is made, there's more pressure put on you, and suddenly those differences really start to show themselves.
Yeah.
Because there are things that I'm just not willing to do. You know, that other artists, I think that they would argue they're not willing to do those things either. And to their defense, they probably aren't doing those things. That's just who they are.
Right.
I think in terms of personality, you know, John Legend has a personality that just frankly, it's probably more agreeable than to the average American than mine might be.
Okay.
You know, in terms of our sensibilities. And so that plays out in the music, you know, and I think that there will always, he will probably always find, in at least in American society that's operated by capitalism, the way it works, he will always find a larger audience than I will, because he's been, you know, he's much more comfortable.
Yeah.
In this environment, and much more comfortable expressing himself, which he does very well, very articulate, smart, talented guy.
Yeah.
It seems, at least from my perspective, it's easier for him to operate in that realm than it is for me.
Yeah, because so, I like him, but I think he's great, but it's just like, it was just something, because I think about like you knowing that and still sticking to your guns, like, because it seemed like you were like that, like this self-awareness, like it's something that comes up on the podcast all the time, where I think about, like, even I think about stand-up, where I notice some of my peers where there's this turn to say like, oh, well, this guy did this thing and I don't know if I could do that. You know what I mean? It's not like, it's not a bad thing that this person did, but this person knew what they were selling.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to sell this.
Yeah.
And it's definitely an easier road to go. I've seen, you know, I've seen it. So I think it's just commendable.
I appreciate that. But as artists, you know, we tend to project ourselves, you know, onto peers.
Right.
And their mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Not to pick on John Legend, but John Legend doesn't have the same mindset about that I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Yeah. He's not the same. We're not the same people.
Sure.
So when he's operating on what is seemingly a larger platform than mine, he's not operating there with less principle. You see mm-hmm. what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah.
Not to him.
Right.
You know what I mean? He's not operating there with, you know, not less anything, you know, mm-hmm. he's there and he's just as principled and just as talented and just as all of that as I might perceive myself.
Yeah.
And I just think that it's a good thing to remember, you know,
because
those kinds of things get lost and, you know, somebody might begin to say words like, oh, John Legend is a sellout or less critically acclaimed than you are or less of an artist than you are, which, you know, according to whatever your standards are, that may or may not be true.
Mm-hmm.
But at the bottom line is we all are operating upon a platform. And I think that he's just much more amiable, amenable, agreeable in this platform than I would be.
Yeah.
And that's no knock about either of us. It's just who we are.
Yeah. I thought that was very telling when I heard you talk about that, because there were so many, like there are a couple of guys, like, I think about, like, because you can't really be put in a box like that. Like my parents live about an hour south of Easton, and I went to visit them after, you know, the next day after your show, and I showed them a clip of, showed my dad. My dad's 78 years old, and I said, oh, who was the guy? I said, oh, I got a clip of him, and I was like, yeah, he's just kind of a soul guy.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of like all these, you know. Your influences, Curtis Mayfield, Prince, like, and my dad was like, I think you were playing, maybe you were playing Character or Dust, one of them, and he was just like, yeah, the guy's good, you know, he's like, yeah, he's good. So it was just, so that was, I was thinking around, so 2004, the album comes out, and I was thinking, like, people that I really, like, admire and respect, where I think that they don't, a guy like you doesn't get as much respect as you deserve. And I see like a record like The Love Below come out in 2004 mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. it was like, I like Outkast. I was like, okay, this is cool. And I think like Andre 3000 made it in a way like on the, I got to go back. So 2002 Q-Tip puts out Amplified.
Right.
And it didn't. Late 90s Amplified comes out. Then he puts that Abstractionism record out.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it got shelved. And it was like, it was him. I don't think he was even rapping on it. But there were some good, interesting songs. And that doesn't really see the light of day until like maybe 10 years later.
Right.
And I was like, well, I'm thinking like The Love Below. Like, okay, that's cool. Q-Tip did the same thing, like a similar thing 2 years ago. That shit's interesting too. Why isn't it out? Like, I'm thinking about this as a just as a fan. It's not like who, it's not like who's better or anything like that. And I noticed, like, I'm thinking, okay, you put out these two great albums for Capitol Records, and at the same time, while you're doing that, you got a guy like Javier Colon on the same label, who's doing something a little more. It's R&B, but it's like it's definitely in the pocket, like some good records on there. He's he's doing a something else that's cool too, and he's on the same label as you. Yeah. And like we don't see this guy until he happens to win The Voice for you, and it's just like, what the fuck? Well, this guy had two record deals. He's talented.
Yeah.
What the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking. So I'm thinking like after like On the Jungle Floor, and I find me and my buddy, my best friend, find out, oh, Van Hunt's moving to Blue Note.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking like, okay. I'm thinking you had Norah Jones in, what, 2003, 2004?
Right, yeah.
That reaches this success. She wins a Grammy. Okay, Blue Note. He's taking it to the next level.
Yeah.
And he's going to be more, this is going to be good for him.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at an email that my friend sends me in 2000. Shit, when is this? It's January 2nd, 2008. And he says, I was on V Hunt's site and found this. The album's supposed to drop the same day as Raheem Devon. That would be a good week. And then he copied, like, basically the rollout of you talking about each track on Popular. And reading this shit, and it was just like, fuck, man, this is great. And we're excited. Nothing. It gets shelved. And I'm like, what the fuck? And maybe we get a bootleg later. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
What can you talk about what happened and how you overcame that disappointment? Because I think I'm getting riled up. But I re-listened to this album, like I just revisit, like Blood from a Heart of Stone, probably just sonically my favorite record. Blood from a Heart of Stone, and Feelings, you know. And you can pull some songs that are like, yeah, these are good. These are, you know, good. These are dope.
Yeah.
And I like the whole album, but it's just like, this is from top to bottom. It's a good ass album. It's like one of those things where it's just like, where like an artist like you, where you're doing all these different and eclectic things, but you still, you know, kind of remain yourself at the essence. And the essence is still there. We can still tell it's you. You're not trying to do anything to get on. It's just an evolution, just like the rings in a tree trunk, like getting, you know. So what happened, man?
Well, let's see. And I'm not trying to just defend major labels.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are specific things I can point to.
Okay.
That justify making certain business decisions. And, you know, that takes a longer conversation. But it's not just as simple as we have a major label and they're just like, we don't want to make artistic statements.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because that's not really it. Sure, people within the label who work at the label, you know, they like certain records, they don't like other records, but they're not as a label opposed to putting out artistic shit.
Yeah.
They're just opposed to putting out clunkers.
You know, okay.
That they have to pay for. And if by some chance, you know, Art was selling a lot of records, they wouldn't have a problem putting out Art. As you know, if you go back just to the 70s, you can see that.
Yeah.
But things have changed, and they've perpetuated change. They played a part in it along with all of us. And so that said, you know, I'm not necessarily understanding all of that, you know, in 2008, like I do now in 2019. But still, you know, I had somewhat understood that this is where we would wind up. is in a place where me being myself is has suddenly locked me out of the major music industry. And so I'm stunned, but I'm also numb. You know what I mean? I'm not necessarily in pain when I hear this news. And I'm disappointed because I really wanted people to hear what I had done. This was the first record that I had zero interference from the label until the end. You know what I mean? And so I was able, that record, that's probably what my first record would have sounded like. It's probably a bit of what On the Jungle Floor would have sounded like, with some slight variation. But that I was able to just say things the way I want to say them with that record, both sonically and lyrically and everything. So that part was disappointing and frustrating. I wanted people to hear.
Yeah, 'cause my and this is like my friend, he was t when I was telling him that I had seen your show in Easton, and we just started like reminiscing and talking about your work and stuff, and he was saying like when he was dating his now wife, he made a playlist for her, and he put The Lowest One of My Desires on the playlist, which is a song that's like, I'm not fucking around. I want you. Like he made sure that he put that record on there, and now he's married and they just had a kid not too long ago. So like that's like, I don't know, man. Like it's frustrating for me to hear that. And I obviously I'm sure it's not as much as you were frustrated about it, but it just seemed like it didn't seem that different from what the two previous albums. Obviously it's different like sonically and aesthetically in certain ways, but it was just like, okay, this is another Van Hunt album. This is another chapter in the story that is Van Hunt at this particular time. And it just seemed like there was a little more social commentary.
But the thing is, and you're right. It was a graduation from the first two records, a gradual progression from the first two records. I see it that way too. But you change the circumstances slightly when you go from Capitol to Blue Note. The reason that I even had to go from Capitol to Blue Note was pressure, downward pressure coming from the shareholders on to Capitol. So that's what I was that's why I set up the statement by saying, there are certain business reasons that create an atmosphere where you make certain business choices that kind of outweigh, the holistic element of what you're presenting as a label. So I do understand that. Now, the way the label went about handling that and articulating that to me was unprofessional. But I do understand the decision at the end of the day. So.
And how did so you, I guess after that, what is it like, was it in case of emergency? Did you put that out right after?
Oh, it was about a year after. And just because I had those songs, they were just collections of playlists I've made from the different albums, and just so I was able to put that together and put it out.
And so you just like so, and then you just continued. Like how? What was the period? How long did you take to grieve this album not coming out? Like in 08?
Oh, I didn't take very long because I was working on piano record and doing all kinds of stuff creatively. I had my relationship and I was raising a kid. So I had plenty to keep me busy, even though it was a tough time because nobody understood where things were going, because the recession, was upon us. And so it was, tough. And then, I was still able though to, with the help of my lady, and like I said, being able to focus on raising my kid,
Right.
I was able to spend that time well and be productive, and continue writing, which led me into what were you hoping for? And like
Sure.
even a song from there was a holdover from that period that you're talking about, which was Moving Targets.
Oh man, that's like probably my favorite record off of that one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And it helped. It was a nice cornerstone for what you're hoping for, and helped to center the
Yeah.
record for somebody who hadn't experienced popular. You know what I mean?
Okay.
They could go from the first two records to What Were You Hoping For, and sure, they'd be taken aback by all the distortion, distorted guitars, but they could still center on Moving Targets to kind of
Yeah, that sound like
bridge them.
that record sounds like something that they would play. You could almost hear that on like a late like a nighttime soap where somebody's like thinking about their relationship or something. Like it's just like it's like kind of it's cinematic in that way.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. Like how you kept because it's hard like dealing with rejection and something you believe in and it getting crushed. But I guess it's sort of like the nature of the game. So how did you feel like when you were touring and people would ask for songs from that album because it leaked?
I didn't have a problem with that at all. In fact, I was glad it leaked.
Okay.
I wanted people to hear the music.
Yeah.
That's always been, primary to me.
Okay.
Obviously,
Yeah.
it was more important than, making money or becoming a big star or any of that. I just had this music, that I wanted to show people,
Yeah, sure.
and that was really it, man. So there's a lot of self-fulfillment that I
Yeah.
had even by the time, I'm on tour, even, even before What Were You Hoping For came out, but certainly
Right.
after What Were You Hoping For, I was largely fulfilled by my ability to, create and to get it to people who might want to hear it.
Yeah. Do you think it's best to go? What do you think is best for artists to do like now in this climate? Is it to go independent or?
Well, most artists don't have a choice,
Yeah.
and that's kind of always been the case when you're talking about the way things are set up in our society. However, there are a lot more options now for someone to set up their own business,
Right.
and they're not going to reach any large number of people at any given point in time, but they can make a living at it, and they can reach a significant amount of people over a longer period of time, and they can do it without a whole lot of inorganic interjection, from business,
Right,
which
right.
I because I think that even though I'm a fan of, at least if you're trying to put out music in America, I'm a fan of the artist understanding the commercial aspect of selling art. I think it's important for artists to understand how the music is made, the technology behind it, and how the music is sold, the marketing and the promotion. However, that said, I'm not a fan of business playing a creative role in the making of the music.
Sure.
And I also think that artists need to keep their noses out of how effective a marketing person or a promotional person can be with selling their stuff. Once you deliver that music and it's exactly what you want, if a marketing and a promoter comes up to you and says, "Can I have this layer of that music so I can go sell it?" You have no business telling them what layer they can pick and choose. That's like telling your audience they can only like certain songs, you know what I mean? Or only
Yeah.
have a certain type of interpretation. No, the business needs to stay out of the artistic side. The artistic side needs to primarily stay out of the business until, you start making choices that change your principles. Then of course you don't want to do that. But I think that both worlds can coexist without invading each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think it's one of those things where it's just like from a listener and a fan standpoint, where it was just there's a frustration in like seeing people that you really enjoy and appreciate. Because I was pissed when that happened. And then like a year, maybe like a few years like prior, maybe like Glenn Lewis, like he's still working. He's doing his thing. Mm-hmm. But it frustrated me like seeing a guy like that where it was just like, okay, World Outside My Window, I thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
And then it takes him until for whatever circumstances till like maybe 2013 to put out another proper album.
Yeah.
And it's just like that frustration that whereas you see the talent is there, it's mm-hmm. not, you know, and it's just like, well, what the fuck? Okay, enough of that. So I want to close with one more nerd question. Okay. And then I'll let you go on with your life.
Well, you know what? Let me just say one thing though about the last comment you made, you know, about Glenn Lewis. Just one quick thing.
Sure.
It's frustrating, I think, for the audience because they can see, as you said, you can see the talent,
mm-hmm.
and you just want to have it. Like, what's the problem?
Yeah.
And there are many, many problems that stand in the way because of the economic platform we all must operate upon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what presents the problems.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And if we could work to change that dynamic, it would all be so much easier. Where the there wouldn't be such a thick middleman syndrome
yeah.
in between the art and the audience. That's all I want to say.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that I think now, I guess in this day and age, like you can see like a behind the scenes thing where like an EPK of something. You can see that on a YouTube channel. Like you can mm-hmm. see like behind the scenes, the artist in the studio or hanging out with his mm-hmm. producers and thinking up of concepts. And I didn't really see it that much with black music where like that contemporary, I know neo soul is what they tried to label it and stuff. And, mm-hmm. and like, I remember like Glenn Lewis coming off of, I think he was on Epic. And then he had a live DVD.
Mm.
And I remember that live DVD where it was like, oh, that's fucking great.
Yeah.
And I just didn't see that with a lot of black music. And it was almost, I mean, he was a unicorn in that sense where, you know, just an artist that I liked that had like a DVD. I don't know I don't know why I'm bringing that up. But I just, I don't know. It's just, it's kind of to your point where it's just like, well, where, like, I think Glenn Lewis and Usher are mm-hmm. the only people that I have like music DVDs of that are like black artists, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Usher, you know, like, and it's, I'm an Usher fan or whatever, but it's just like, mm-hmm. it's just like, I mean, there's so many more talented people.
I think that you know the technology is now meeting back up with the art.
That's true. That is very true. With Instagram and Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
I guess those needs are met there. So I just started getting like streaming music, like Tidal and all that stuff.
Right.
It's only been a year. But my last question for you. Like the last nerd question I'll have is, I want to ask you: do you have like with regards to the first three albums? Do you have a fascination with the end? What, like just based on the records that are on the like Popular has It All Ends in Tears. Mm-hmm. The On the Jungle Floor is The Night is Young. And even if we're talking about on that, even if we're talking about the bonus record, God Moves at Midnight, that's still kind of like a closure. And then Out of the Sky, you know, that's like, is there a fascination with the end, a fixation, or do you just know how to put together good albums that end well?
Well, I with all modesty, I would say that I've been trained in how to put together a sequence.
Sure.
However, it's not until you just brought it up that I can see, you know, I can look at all three of those endings and say, oh yeah, that maybe there is some fixation with how things end. And as I think you said earlier, things never end, you know. But we also spoke about earlier about the perspective, and if and that's really what makes the difference between the beginning, the end, and the next record is where, you know, we as artists and audience sit, you know, in that place, because it demarcates a time for us, and that becomes a beginning, so to speak. But it isn't really, you know what I mean? It's just a place we marked, you know what I mean? And but we need those things, you know, to go in and out of phases and to kind of live. And so I think that each of those songs represents that for me. It's a kind of an opening. It's an ending that has an opening, a portal to the next world. And it kind of shows you that things never really end.
That's yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think even like when we talked about earlier, like stripping down the music, where when I heard like the Night Is Young, that acoustic version, I guess what was on the, I think that was on the popular EP. That was where it hit me even more, and then I'm just thinking about it, just revisiting those songs, and you know, to talk to you about them, it was just sort of like, well, shit, he was only 36. You know, when that record came out, it's like, what was like, well, I'm 39. Well, is it over? You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, it's like, wow. But I
But,
mean.
you know, again, like that's that feeling that I had when I made the first record. It's like there was a shadow on the screen, if you will, of what my life would be 20 years from now. And I knew I needed to explain that to myself at that age. You know what I'm saying? The Night Is Young is very similar to that. There was definitely a part of me that was like, okay, you're going to be like 72, and this is what you're gonna need to express. So you know what I mean? Like you need to have this moment. And so that because that question struck me too, even as I'm sitting in the studio and I was writing it. And I was like, you know what? I'm actually young. I actually was 34, 35 when I was actually cutting it. Like this sounds like an old man singing this
Well,
song.
you know, it's one of those things, man, because it's I it made me think about that too, and it's just like it's like, don't they know I'm still here pushing against the atmosphere? And it's like, fuck, man. That's another one of those lines where it's just like, holy shit, because even like Out of the Sky, like you're definitely saying like, what's I'm trying I've reached the end of is it I've reached the end of my story? I don't know. That's more, that comes off as more of a curtain call in credits. Obviously there it's synonymous like in this in the current conversation, but that one, the On the Jungle Floor, seemed even more to my point of just like, well, shit. And then like God Moves at Midnight, which I really was just introduced thanks to Tidal. I was like, I didn't know that song existed. And so I was listening to that and thinking like, does that even work if I ask him this question?
was funny is I wanted to the textures in God Moves at Midnight, I wanted those on the album version of The Night Is Young. But just because of the process of the record, again, I wasn't producing that record by myself, and we had a deadline, so I couldn't actually get Night Is Young to where I was really completely satisfied. It was that's why I cut it again, the acoustic version that you heard, trying to bring in those elements. But you know, ultimately, I just wound up, you know, having The Night Is Young and God Moves at Midnight kind of make the statement that I wanted to make with one song.
Well, even like, 'cause God Moves at Midnight, 'cause when I think about a lot of your work and I think about like the control that you have in your voice, which was really like weird to me when you said on your interview with Dax, where you like, you hate singing. I'm like, what the fuck? Like this guy with this great voice that you hate singing.
No, I appreciate that, man. But yeah, I do not enjoy singing. The last tour, the one you saw,
yeah,
beginning in Easton, that's the most fun I've had.
Oh, singing, really? Okay.
Ever.
Cool.
Yeah.
Because I think there was a part where I even said on the podcast, I think when I was talking about going to your show, like how the guys seem to be more excited, just be like fanboys. Yeah. And like when you were like trying to get everybody to sing, you're like, no, dude, we paid to see you. Like not in an asshole way where it's like, you guys sing it. But it was just like, no, dude, your voice is fucking phenomenal. Please sing these songs. It was just like it was that thing. But even like God Moves at Midnight, where it was even like you kind of opened up a portal to yourself where it was just like, When I'm listening to your records, it's like you had control over your voice, and there's a moment where you talk about, like, I think right before the line where you say, like, taking the long way around to goodbye.
Yeah.
And like you kind of have, it's like a run, kind of like a yell in a way, where you kind of go a little off voice. It's like you're still on key, but it's just like, it's like, yeah, that's him opening up, and that, this is like, you know, for somebody that's more, that's like very, there's like a precision. I think there's a precision in your voice that allows people to appreciate the poetry. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
So it's like you kind of have to be there in order to get these lyrics and to really get it enough to even want to unpack them. If there's something to unpack. And that's what I appreciated about that. So I still think that works as a bonus record ending on the Jungle Floor.
Yeah.
So you definitely did that. So I'm not crazy for thinking about, I just basically asked you that so I know that I'm not crazy. Yeah. And to think about, like, okay, all right, yeah.
No, not at all, man. Not at all. But you know, there's so much more, you know, to these stories, that I would never, you know, ever have time to get all of it out. But, you know, the rest, to know some of those things would make much more sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, I'm really satisfied, you know, and I signed off on all those records.
Yeah.
And, you know, man, I'm fulfilled.
Yeah.
As an artist. I know that sounds like I'm about to ride off into the sunset.
No, yeah. I understand. I totally understand. I mean, it's like you're able, and it's something that I'm coming to grips with, because just a little something about me. Like I'm like in between two worlds, like a guy that is an actor and comedian. Like I've dedicated my life to the arts, but I still have to have a day job. I still have to pay the bills. I'm almost 40, and I'm thinking about, like, I think I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, but at the same time, like, success, like, just getting, like, starting to get, like, TV and film roles, they're small parts, but it's building.
Yeah.
And I feel like, and I got my first SAG gig, my union gig,
nice.
at 36. That's 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And when I got the gig, I broke down in my car.
Wow.
Man. And I called my parents and I was just like, I guess it's not all for naught, you know? So it's something that's like, like where it was just like, okay, all this stuff there is something on the plate. Not even, it's because I had people like my parents rooting for me.
Yeah.
Where it's like a lot of my peers don't, you know? And it sort of was. So it's sort of like that was a relief, and then there is kind of comfort that I did it in the way that I felt like I was supposed to. I felt like I respect the craft so much that I want to go to school, I want to learn about it, and I want to be able to work and just exist. It doesn't have to be, I don't have to be famous. I want to make money. Making it for me would be like not having to get up at 4:30 in the morning to go to an office job.
I'd
rather be going to set or whatever, but you know,
exactly, man. And I mean, I had this discussion that was along these lines, because one of the shows we didn't talk about was an appearance I made at the North Hollywood Library.
Okay.
And that was what we discussed, was the difference between making music and making music to make money. And I was trying to make sure people understood that I have a respect for business as an expression itself, but business doesn't need to be within the craft. You know, whether you're talking about stand-up acting or making music. But business, you know, commercialism can sell the craft, and the craft can be created and then sold. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, but the two can't intermingle before one or the other is ready. You know what I mean? So as long as that's happening, there's no need to make a discussion about, oh, I'm making this music to make money, or I'm acting to make money. You know what I mean? We can make music for the sake of the craft, and we can act and learn acting for the sake of the craft, and then allow the monetary process to have its say. And
Yes.
believe it or not, like it'll have even more of a say. If you can do that, you can really give it something robust to work with, and use that same kind of mentality in choosing your team and, you know, choosing the choices that you make. It'll grow in ways that you know, become emergent and grow in ways that are exponential, things that you didn't even think about. And that's why not only am I self-fulfilled, but the riches that I perceive that I have now, they're not just monetary, they're all around me. You know what I mean? Like, and this conversation with you, and the conversation I'm going to have with my kid later on, the conversation I'm going to have with my mom or my lady, it's going to reflect all of these, you know, things and the philosophical approach that I have to life. You can't replace that. You know, you can't minimize it in any way or diminish it. It's just too powerful.
I think that's a great way to end it. Van Hunt, man, thank you so much. It's been a fucking honor to talk to you and for you to take the time, man. This is when I started doing this podcast 6 years ago, didn't think this was going to happen, man. It's an honor.
Yeah, well, I wish you all the best, man. I can't wait to see you on stage myself.
Yeah, I got to get to LA, man. You're in LA, right?
Well, right now I'm in North Georgia, but yeah, I'll be in LA in about 10 days.
Okay, yeah, I got to get out there and start performing and stuff. Yeah, this has been. I wanted to ask you one question off mic, but after that, so I'm going to cut this thing off, man. So this has been great, Van. Check up, plug some stuff. Trim is out. Your tour. Are you starting back up?
Yeah, we're doing another tour in the States, all the way through to the end of August.
Okay,
So
is that on your website yet?
not yet.
Okay,
In fact, we're going to put it up there today.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And I'll post this and put the links and everything to your stuff in the notes
Thank
and all
you.
that.
Yeah,
So this has been great. Thanks for listening, everybody. Take it
man.
easy.
Thank you.
All right.